Welcome to the 1994 Sunstone Symposium West. I'm really delighted to see you all here. I'll have a few more welcoming words in a minute, but even by Mormon Standard Time, it's time to get started. I've invited Lou Wallace to give us opening prayer. Thanks.
Our Father in heaven, we thy servants and children have assembled this evening to enjoy the fellowship found here and to study and think about the concepts and ideas so necessary for our progression in our eternal journey. We ask thee for compassion towards those who do not agree with us, for forgiveness for the weaknesses of men, both high and low, for tolerance of other ideas, for open-mindedness, for the ability to open up and express our friendship one for another. We ask for more spirit of love in the type shown by our Savior, and we ask it in his name. Amen.
Thanks very much, Lou, for that tone that you saw. As I was having dinner with a couple of our invited guests, when you plan something like this, you hope people will show up, and I expressed my relief that they'd shown up and my joy, and she said, "Well, Kim, you sure know how to throw a good party." And I was feeling about that afterwards, that if I had to choose any party to throw, this represents a good subset of the people that I would want there. I appreciate the fellowship, the joy that we find in each other's company, and in sharing our ideas and exploring the gospel that we believe in one with another. I especially want to thank the people who've prepared their thoughts, their ideas, that have given of their time and their courage to prepare things for us. I'll talk more about that tomorrow. But as I've looked at the program, I'm extremely happy with the program this year. There's a tremendous variety of papers, and there are some themes that I've especially enjoyed seeing on the program. They're the usual historical papers, which I enjoy, and they're the usual social issues of the day papers. There are also, I've thought, our personal experience with some of those social issues, how we were reacting, personal experience at a different level, just talking about dreams, talking about singlehood, understanding some of the things that we've been going through recently in the church, exploring the reasons for some kinds of tension and schism, and a couple of papers on working constructively and creatively within an institution where there are differences, where there are schisms, where there are difficulty. I've appreciated that people have been moved to try to explore those sorts of things. I hope that we can do it all in a spirit of learning from each other, of experiencing each other's experience, be it positive, be it negative, be it mixed, as all of ours is. Without any more ado, I want to introduce Marie Cornwall. She's spoken before here. She's a social scientist, is on leave from the BYU Faculty of Sociology at the moment, holds the Bell S. Spafford Chair of Social Work in the Graduate School of Social Work at the University of Utah, has just finished editing the first serious sociological study of Mormonism since 1957. Somebody said the first ever, and I said, I think I remember Thomas O'Day, but that was hasn't dealt with very current issues. So she doesn't have to do it. I will tell you that she edited this together with Tim Heaton and Lawrence Young. It will be coming out in a couple of months from University of Illinois Press, a serious collection of essays of a wide variety of social scientists looking at Mormon experience. You'll find a flyer about the book in the book room. If you sign up on the back before May, you get 20% off. Okay, end of advertisement. So we're glad to have Marie here. Thanks.
Thank you. It's so rare that sociologists get asked to really talk to a general audience about sociology. I was thinking about oxymorons, actually, as Albert was driving me here from the airport, and a bus was moving along the freeway about as slowly as we were, and on the side of the bus it said, "Commuter Express." And much like that as an oxymoron, I'm thinking, you know, I was thinking what Jay Leno or David Letterman would do with the oxymoron interesting sociologist. It's not something that people talk about a lot. And if you doubt what I'm saying, just go to any bookstore and notice the difference between the large section on psychology and the little section that sometimes you can't find on sociology. So not only do people not invite sociologists to speak, they don't read their books. So I really appreciate that you're here tonight. This is nice. When I first approached the University of Illinois Press with the idea of this book, the working title was The Sociology of Mormonism. And we had to get rid of that title very quickly. So now we are to contemporary Mormonism. Let me say, before I talk about some of the things that are in this book, and actually some of the things that aren't in this book, let me talk a little bit about the sociological approach to the study of Mormonism. Sociology and religion, at least from the sacred point of view, don't mix very well. Because truth is not our subject. We're simply wanting to look at a social institution. And the fact that we are not engaged, and blatantly not engaged, in anything similar, for example, to what historians do in trying to write sacred history, makes us suspect. The second thing that makes us suspect is that for the longest time, most sociologists predicted that religion would fail and disappear in the modern world because there would be no more need for an explanation that grew out of social interaction rather than the rational scientific approach. Fortunately, for those of us who study religion, it has not died away. And in fact, especially during the 80s, we've come to realize how much more important it is to continue to study religion and its impact on society. What we do, while I think the humanities and theology attempts to discover the divine in human life, I think sociology attempts to discover the humanness in divine things, and that gets us in trouble. We like to do it anyway. Now, to give you an example of the trouble it gets us in, I'll never forget a time when I visited with Larry Young, one of the other editors, and Eileen Barker, who studies the Unification Church. She's at the London School of Economics and is a sociologist. She was visiting in Salt Lake. We'd had her out to present a lecture at BYU. And Larry and I took her to the visitor center in Salt Lake. And we were at the place just outside where the baptismal font on the auction are, and the guide that we had asked was taking us through and explaining the plan of salvation with all her heart and soul. She was very much into it. And Larry at that point turned to Eileen and said, "You understand, of course, that this is the cosmic myth of Mormonism." The young woman turned bright red, was sure she needed to defend something, but didn't know how or what to say. And Larry kindly had to point out to her that just because a sociologist says something's a cosmic myth doesn't mean that they don't believe it's the myth. It's just... as we pursue our research, we really are simply trying to understand the social dimensions going on. There are a number of approaches that sociologists might take. One, of course, is simply looking at the belief systems of religion and seeing what their impact is on individual lives. Another is a more comparative approach in which we understand religion as a social category, much like ethnicity, race, gender, and that what we want to understand is how people in different religious, with different religious preferences or religious orientations, may approach life differently, and how it influences their quality of life. Social scientists in the past, anywhere from Marx to Weber to Freud, tended to emphasize religion as something that did not necessarily, and in fact frequently, discouraged quality of life. The problem is social scientists look at the impact of religion on people's lives, we frequently find that it actually contributes to quality of life. And so that's one aspect of looking at religion. A third one, is looking at religious institutions, understanding their growth, why they grow, and understanding why they die. Secularization has been a big theory for many years in the social sciences, and more recently has been very much challenged to suggest that churches die, religion lives on. That churches, as they become large and institutionalized, become irrelevant and disconnected from the common folk. And when that happens, the common folk look elsewhere. Well, what does all this have to do with Mormonism? Well, let me just share with you some of the things that we know because of within Mormonism. First of all, I wanted to say three reasons why it is that this book is coming out now. One of them is directly related to the fact that in the late 70s, the LDS Church headquarters organized what is now called the Evaluation Research Information Department. And currently, they have about 30 social science professionals working full-time, evaluating church programs, trying to understand conversion process, activity, inactivity, whatever. And I have done some research for them in doing that. The creation of that office helped to legitimize the sociology of religion as a topic at Brigham Young University, where there were several good social scientists. So you find within a few years after that office was organized, more BYU faculty beginning to focus on religion. And if you look at who's doing in the BYU sociology faculty, who's doing studies on religion, a good half of the faculty now are doing some aspect or another in terms of research on Mormons or on religion. But another important thing that happened during this period, and that is that the church simply got large enough, particularly in the United States, that Mormons begin to show up in national samples. Now, in the United States, we have, in terms of the study of religion, we have a slight problem in that the census data do not ask religious preference, because that has been interpreted as a violation of church's state. On the other hand, in Canada, the Canadian census does ask religious preference. So it's actually possible for us to know more about Canadian Mormons compared to the rest of the population than it's possible for us to know about U.S. Mormons. But aside from the census information, the general social surveys, the some youth studies have begun to pick up sufficient numbers of Latter-day Saints in their samples that we're able to actually make some comparisons on the broader about between Mormons and others. And actually, I'm going to give you some examples of those. The other thing that happened, again, in the late 70s was this, the organization of the Society for the Sociological Study of Mormon Life. And every year that organization meets with the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion. And actually, this book comes out of a 1989 meeting of that organization, the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion, in Salt Lake City, in which there were 8 sessions on Mormons, and we culled from the best of those to put this book together. So this book has been a long time in coming. Now, let me begin. Rodney Stark starts our the book starts out with a chapter from Rodney Stark, who is an interesting character in the sociology of religion, and likes to stir up the waters. In 1984, he published an article in which he pointed out that between 1930 and 1980, the Mormon Church grew at approximately 50% per decade. Having discovered that, he calculated that by the end of 2080, which would have been 100 years from the time he was first did the analysis, there would be 265 million Mormons on Earth. Now, even if you used a more conservative measure, if you assume that the rate would fall to an average of only 30%, there would be 60 million Mormons at the end of 2080. Now, this notion, he points out, was very frightening to most social scientists. To think that there would be that many Mormons. When we put this book together, we went back to him and said, take another look at your statistics. It's been almost a decade. And tell us how close you were. Well, at the end of 1980, his projections, when his projections began, there were 4,644,768 members of the Mormon Church worldwide. At the end of 1990, there were 7,762,000. I think that's a rounded number. I don't know why the first one wasn't rounded. Anyway, for the first 10 years, then, following his projection, the overall growth rate was more than 67%. So his initial calculations were low in terms of growth rate. Now, some of you out there are probably thinking that the reason it's so high is because the Mormon fertility rate is so high, and as long as Mormons keep having babies, that will continue. However, he points out that most of that growth is not a function of fertility. For example, in 1991, there were a total of 75,000 children of record that were baptized. Okay. In contrast, there were 297,770 converts baptized. Now, that's a comparison of 3.97 converts per every child baptized. Okay. So, almost four times as many in terms of the church growth. Now, what accounts for this incredible growth? Some folks are saying that it won't last, that we'll top out, whatever. Well, Rodney Stark is saying that Mormonism is a classic example of the growth of conservative religions as the world faces modernity. And in fact, although this is a rather strange approach, he points out that there is a high correlation between Mormon church membership and a number of other factors, such as the percent of people, and this is based on Canadian data, the percent of people who report that their religious preference is none. So in an area where there are a high percentage of people who report they have no religious preference, there is a 0.97 correlation with the church, Mormon membership of the church. Per capita alcohol consumption is strongly correlated with Mormon membership. The abortion rate is strongly correlated. Playboy circulation rate is strongly correlated. The cocaine arrest rate is strongly correlated. And the indecent exposure arrest rate is in Canada is strongly correlated with the number of Mormon membership in the area. Now, he's kind to us by saying that he doesn't think it's the Mormons who are reading Playboy, having abortions, buying cocaine, or exposing themselves indecently. But that what happens is that people living in places where there are no strong religious norms and mores and a strong religious authority, And where there is a lot of indication of modernity and the loss of tradition are the very places in which the church, particularly a conservative church, is likely to grow. Now, you might ask, well, why is that so? Well, if you think about it for a minute, who is it that converts to Mormonism? We hear these miracle stories of nuns and priests and Baptist ministers who convert to Mormonism, but they are miracle stories just because they don't happen except once in a great while. The folks who join Mormonism are the folks who have no religious preference. The people who are most receptive to talking about religion are the people who are not connected into a religious group, because those that are connected into a religious group have what sustains their religious identity and whatever. So, for the most part, you don't find people joining Mormonism who are strongly integrated into another religion. You just don't find that. Okay. So, from Rodney Stark, we not only know that the church is still growing tremendously, but as Rod emphasizes, that the rate of growth is not likely to decline, because actually every day there are more and more people who have no religious preference. And who are these people with no religious preference? They're the children of religious people who then have children, and then the grandchildren go looking for a religion. Okay? So, it takes a social climate that allows people to search in order for Mormonism to thrive. Okay? He goes ahead, and I don't want to tell you the ending here, but he does use the same theory to look at the growth in Latin America to carry on his analysis. Well, some of you may say, be a little skeptical in terms of, but what are those baptisms really? Well, Larry Young in his chapter deals a little bit with that. First of all, let me point out, he has calculated the growth rates by certain areas of the church. These are growth rates between 1986 to 1991. In the West Indies, the 1991 Mormon population was 56,000. That was a 167% increase from the 5 years before. In Mexico and Central America, it was 869,000 in 1991, a growth rate of 123% from 5 years before. South America, 1.4 million, 73% growth. Asia, almost 500,000, 71% growth. Europe, 37% growth. Canada, 14% growth. And United States, 10% growth. Now, this is really consistent with Rod Stark, because the United States is one the most religious industrialized country. And it is the one country where the growth rate is the lowest. Okay? Now, Portugal, only 28,000 Mormons there, but a 294% growth rate in a five-year period. Ghana, only 9,000 there, but it represents 200%. Guatemala, 125,000, represents 187% growth rate in 5 years. Now, what about retention, though? Part of what, you know, Harold Bloom came out with a book recently and said, there's nothing more American than Mormons. Actually, Larry takes him on and suggests that that's not true. One of the characteristics of the study of the sociology of religion is to look at the relationship between the growth of an organization and the amount of tension that exists between the broader society. Now, part of what we're experiencing today in Mormonism, I think, is a function of particularly the intellectuals, who want to reduce the amount of tension within Mormonism, between Mormonism and the general general society. Don't be so conservative. You know, relax a little bit. More liberal. You know, our friends think we're strange. Move, you know, let's relax a bit. Well, but it's the religions that are in high tension with society who actually grow more. Now, how much tension is there between Mormonism and its host society? Well, it depends on where you go. And one of the indications you might that Larry Young uses, is the percent of adult male members in 1980 who had been ordained to the Melchizedek priesthood. Okay, so this is an indicator of retention. That is, if you take 100 adult males and only 20 of them have been ordained to the Melchizedek priesthood, we can assume that that's an area in which there is a high degree of tension between the Mormon society and the broader society, and that it is very difficult to keep a person as part of the group membership because of the tension that exists between society, Mormon society, and the host society. Those are the kinds of situations in which Mormons can't get jobs if people find out they're Mormon. And in some areas of the world, that's a critical issue. In Utah, that is not a critical issue when it comes to getting a job. Okay, so let's look at for example, in Utah, the percent of adult male members who've been ordained in 1980 was 70%. So in Utah, Mormonism can be said to be the host society. Only 20% aren't ordained. In the United States generally, that drops to 59%. In Canada, 52%. In Africa, 39%. In Japan, 17%. In Mexico, 19%. Central America, 23%. West Indies, 25%. Two things then. The growth, we have a great deal of growth, but we're not holding on to them, and we're less likely to hold on to those who join in societies that are in greater tension. I think we as intellectuals sometimes get frustrated that nobody cares that we want to protest. But when you've got general authorities looking at Japan, where only 17% of the adult males have been ordained, they've got a major problem there in terms of maintaining commitment. That's a far serious problem than any of you intellectuals, okay? So that's where the focus is. I don't want to hurt your feelings, but I think that's... they don't either, but, you know, numbers reign here. So what you find is, for example, the bombings in Peru and Bolivia are then an indication of the strain that's created from rapid growth and from also the exportation of an American church to a foreign culture. And Mormonism, that is one of the greatest challenges in the 21st century for Mormonism, because we don't have models of how to take a highly centralized, hierarchical organization and have it fit and accommodate to a multitude of host societies as represented by the various world cultures that we're talking about. So religion then becomes, Mormonism even with a high centralized control, becomes a very different experience in Latin America and in Argentina and in Japan and China. That creates a strain that has to be responded to. Let me shift now and shift away from the issue of organizational growth and the strains, and look at how religion seems to influence behavior and quality of life. In this book, we've got three studies, one by Tim Heaton on Mormon families, one by Stephen Barr on adolescent drug use, and one by several authors, one of them, Alan Bergen's one, but also myself, looking at mental health issues. Now, I think this is a question Mormons ask more than anything else, because you're supposed to reap blessings, right? There's supposed to be some visible result of all your effort. And if there isn't any visible result, then something's drastically wrong. Well, Tim Heaton compares Mormon families with other families of other religious groups on a whole variety of indicators. Frequency of sex is reported by men and women. Quality of marriage, marital satisfaction, parental satisfaction, and doesn't really find any difference between Mormon families and other families. There are no significant differences, except for four things. And you may have seen his earlier article on the four C's of Mormonism, in which he reports that Mormons are more likely to be chaste before marriage, emphasize marriage, conjugality. Mormons are more likely to get married. If they do get divorced, they're more likely to remarry, have more children, although the rate of the fertility rate varies by country. In Mexico, for example, in modernizing countries, being a Mormon actually reduces your fertility. In the United States, being a Mormon increases your fertility, particularly if you're well-to-do, and not much differences in Great Britain and Japan, as I recall. But and then finally, as we all know, the traditional gender roles. But those are the only indicators that you can really find that suggest differences in Mormon families with other families. People have a hard time believing Tim when he tells them that, because they're sure that they're doing better than that. But and then there's the opposite response with regard to mental health, that everyone's sure that Mormons are more depressed, particularly Mormon women. In a national study, the same one actually that Tim Heaton had used, we had sufficient numbers of Mormons, both men and women, to compare them with eight different religious groups using 10 items of a well-being scale that was sort of like the Beck Depression scale. You know, how many days do you feel blue? Do you have a hard time eating, hard time sleeping? How many days are you depressed, etc.? We did find an effect for a religious group. And the Mormon women were about as depressed as women in other conservative religions. Controlling for education and age, the least depressed are the liberal Protestants. And the most depressed are people with no religious preference. What's interesting in this data is that the Mormon men are the least depressed of all religious groups. And that's what makes women depressed. And just recently in Utah, they did a quality of life survey and found that women in Utah were less satisfied with men in Utah. And that wasn't hard to understand, although interestingly enough... there wasn't much difference between Mormon women and women of other faiths either in terms of quality of life or on depression. That doesn't say there's nothing going on in terms of quality of life. I think what it does say, and there are people exploring this, Candy Brinkman, who is a PhD candidate at the University of Utah and a Catholic living in Utah, is making a comparison of Catholic and Mormon women in terms of quality of life through qualitative studies, and has a very good research design. attempting to understand the role of identity in the life satisfaction of women. And I think her research will help us understand better. I don't think yet that we've really measured what it is that we're all feeling when it comes to trying to understand the experience of Mormon women. But going on to Steve Barr, Steve Barr finds that, and this study is based on a national sample, and with thousands of respondents. In fact, there are almost 1,000 just Mormon respondents, and he has 7 other different religious groups that he looks at. And as we might expect, given the fact that the Mormonism emphasizes the word of wisdom and restrictions of drug use, that LDS youth are less likely to use drugs. In this national sample, 14% of Latter-day Saints reported, these were high school seniors, 14% reported they'd smoked in the last month, 33% had used alcohol in the last month, 13% had used marijuana in the last month, 13% had used amphetamines in the last year, and 8% had used cocaine in the last year. Now, by comparison, the highest group, actually, of drug use, again, are those with no religious preference. So, for example, cigarette use is 32% among youth with no religious preference, 14% for LDS. 70% for alcohol use, again, 33% for LDS. 31% for marijuana use, again, 13% for LDS. 18% for amphetamines, and 13% for LDS. There's actually the least amount of difference by religion on the use of amphetamines. And then cocaine, 18% among those with no religious preference, and 8% among Mormons. So there is a difference. Furthermore, Steve finds that being religiously active has a greater effect among LDS youth than among youth in any other religious group. So there's an interaction there, that if you have an active LDS senior high school person, he or she is much less likely to use drugs all of these types, compared to any other religious preference, no matter what their religious activity is. Now, a part of that effect, as Steve points out, is simply that you have a religion that very specifically places controls on people about what's acceptable. But we still, and we have a slight problem in terms of causal direction with this data. Because, as in data that I've analyzed on LDS youth myself, it would appear that being religious doesn't necessarily protect one from experimenting with drugs, experimenting with drugs is more likely to discourage religious activity. So the other way to look at it is that as individuals begin to experiment with all the possibilities out there, that occurs when you're talking about teenagers during that critical period in which they're forming their identity, and that there is a sorting out process as individuals decide, am I the type of person that stays here and doesn't do it, or am I the type of person that steps over here and uses drugs? And in that part of that decision making is also the has an impact on their religious activity. And in fact, the best correlate that we found in terms of kids making those decisions has to do with the quality of relationship with their parents and the amount of control that their parents maintain over their activities, particularly in the younger teenage years, 11, 12, and 13. If you don't have control by 16, But you know that, right? Okay, so it's the 11, 12, 13, 14-year-olds that need to be nurtured along in this role. Well, let me go to one more area. I can't talk about this without talking about my own chapter. My chapter, people laugh when they hear what my chapter's about. I spend 25 pages talking about the institutional role of Mormon women. And people think that's kind of funny, because since Mormon women have no institutional role. Other people think it's more funny than you guys. But part of what I attempt to do in the paper here is to look at what I see operating with the church in terms of men and women having familial and institutional roles. And that in the early church, there were efforts, Joseph Smith, I think, and the earlier patriarchs were attempting to create a society, an agrarian society, on traditional notions of the familial racial, role of both men and women, the patriarchal priesthood. And that the process of institutionalization has really interfered with that and in some ways made it far more difficult for us to understand and renegotiate gender roles within Mormonism. And I try to make the case also that Mormonism is not unique in this experience. For example, and let me just read this in the interest of time. A cursory examination of women's involvement in welfare societies suggests that women tended to lose autonomy and control as the societies they founded became institutionalized and bureaucratized. Both Methodist and Presbyterian women lost control of their benevolent and mission societies as their denominations reorganized. When the Methodist Episcopal Church reorganized the women's missionary societies under the Board of Missions in 1906, and the Presbyterian Church did the same 17 years later, the women's societies were placed under the direct supervision of male-run mission boards. Unitarian and Universalist clergy women experienced a similar decline in autonomy about the same time period. Cynthia Grant Tucker describes their effectiveness and autonomy as they minister to people living along what in the late 19th century was the Western frontier. Supervision from the Eastern male-dominated hierarchy led to the women's dwindling numbers and effectiveness. And this is a quote. The sisterhood's decline came at a time when the focus of Unitarian expansion was shifting to university centers and urban showcases. At about the same time in history, Mormon women lost organizational autonomy because male-defined responsibilities were gradually defined as priesthood responsibilities. Now, I'm basically talking about really around the 1920s and the Progressive Era and the efforts of Mormon women to expand into welfare organizations. And the problem, I think, is that we have today is partly hierarchical, a function of the hierarchical and bureaucratic institutions that also came of age in the first part of this century. The new institutional forms that developed at the turn of the century had a profound impact on women's lives. As a market economy, welfare agencies, hospitals, and educational systems were established, and a society became more bureaucratized, much of what had been women's work, including home production of food and clothing, responsibility for the moral virtues of society, and the care of the poor, the sick, and the dying, societal shift, help subordinate women in new and different ways. And certainly that happened within Mormonism. And to give you an idea, as correlation decreased the auxiliary's responsibilities, women took the back seat in many areas in which they had formerly been prominent. And I'm sure you've all heard this, but let me give you my version. Welfare services, leadership training, publishing, policy setting with regards to women's organizations. The presences of the women's auxiliaries became less visible. Women of the church no longer heard from their women leaders through auxiliary conferences, newsletters, or conference visits. The tradition of women leading women became lost in an emphasis on priesthood line and priesthood authority. Functioning within the priesthood line of authority required ordination to a priesthood office as well as authorization from those with authority. Since women were not ordained, their only institutional role was to, quote, support the priesthood, and none of us know what that means. The change did more than subordinate women. It also implied that their contribution, although necessary, was of secondary importance to the work of men. These changes occurred in the 60s and 70s. Decades of great change for women in American culture. At the very time that women generally were pressing for greater influence in social institutions, the women of Mormonism found themselves outside the hierarchy and with little input on governing councils. Placing the work of the institutional church in the hands of priesthood leaders created human resource demands that enhanced the value of men. The hierarchy focused on church growth, increasing the number of convert baptisms and creating wards, stakes, and administrative areas. Such growth depended on having sufficient numbers of men to carry out the work of the church, not only to baptize but also to administer the ward and stake organizations. While the creation of a new unit of Mormon church government requires the presence of men, the presence of hundreds of women is institutionally insignificant. Women, of course, play a significant role in local congregations, but their work is the work of the familial aspects of Mormonism, nurturing the young and teaching other women. Responsibility for church growth and administration is defined in terms of institutional aspects of the priesthood. The question, therefore, is whether the familial aspects are valued as much as institutional aspects are. In the modern, rational, and bureaucratic world, the familial is less valued. Women's tendency towards religion, their greater willingness to affiliate and participate, created an imbalance in the number of males and females in local congregations. The LDS Church organizational structure assumes that each household constitutes a family, which is the smallest organization, smallest unit of organization. This family is headed by a Melchizedek priesthood holder. Changing demographics created an organizational dilemma for the growing church. Since many households are headed by mothers married to non-member husbands or single mothers or single adults or widows with no priesthood liaison in the home, priesthood-bearing men became a scarce resource. More men were needed to carry out both institutional and familial priesthood roles. As a scarce resource, men became more valued than women, and the attention of the hierarchy focused on somehow restoring the balance by increasing the number of Melchizedek priesthood holders. Having delegated responsibility for women and children to the auxiliaries and the male head of household, church leaders focused on increasing the number of men who had been ordained to the Melchizedek priesthood and encouraging men's institutional and familial participation. An unintended consequence was that women, particularly single or divorced women or women married to non-member husbands, are now more likely to be viewed as a liability than as a resource in the face of the institutionally defined demands of the rapidly growing Mormon Church. So I see that as part of the strain that we're experiencing and feeling here today. Now, there's a lot missing in this study of Mormonism. We just don't know enough yet about the institutional church. We don't know enough about congregational life in all parts of the world. And we certainly don't know and have not paid enough attention to the operation of class within Mormonism. The only class that gets attention is the intellectual elite, and it's not the kind of attention that they appreciate. There is little here and available on the conversion process. There is information on socialization, activity, inactivity, but there is still much research to do with regards to the sociology of religion. Now, let me close. I could take some questions if you'd like. Have any questions? Or we could go socialize, which is what we do best. Yeah. The question's about Christian Science, and I don't know the answer. No. Not that I know of. For the most part, in the United States, we get a lot of people from kind of moderate Protestantism, But again, it's not those who are currently attending. But that's in their religious background. Let me say one more thing about that. Actually, one of the things that is encouraging the creation of religious nuns is the intermarriage that's occurring between religious groups. And typically, when you've got two people marrying who from different groups, the outcome is either that they're raised in the mother's group, mother's religion, or no religion. And as that increases, that actually helps to create the pool of possible converts. But and it also explains why the conservative Christian groups are enemies, because we are in direct market competition with that group. Yeah. Mormons are the only ones that have records that are as good as these that we can track and publish them. A lot of the rest are estimates from those who are currently members of congregations. So in that sense, it's really difficult to measure church growth or decline. And typically that's measured, frequently that's measured by the larger surveys asking people what their preference is and seeing what percent are in the various different groups. Yeah. Well, the Catholic Church is the one model, and this is a rumor. Well, maybe it's a myth that one time they were all passing around the decline and fall of the Holy Roman Empire. I mean, no one wants to follow the Catholic process, and right now the Catholicism is struggling very much itself. I mean, the Pope can't get control over American Catholics. Yeah. The social class for the religious nuns. Armin, do you know that? I also saw.
I think it's a different
one. Well, I have looked at that, and lifelong members tend to be more educated than converts, but the children of converts catch up pretty quickly. So there's still, you know, there's because of the heavy emphasis on education, that they do catch up. Yeah.
Is there any study of
patterns? Actually, there is. There's a book called Falling from the Faith, and I have a chapter in that book. Mormons, Catholics, and Jews are most likely to hold on to their people. That is 80% in the research I've looked at. It's about 80% maintain commitment to the religion in which they're born in. And the liberal Protestants probably having the hardest time in keeping the adherence to their faith. But the Catholics and the Mormons are very high. And Jews, and but that's in preference. That's not necessarily activity. It's that, you know. And actually, I had a small number of cases, but the research that I did suggested that part of what's going on, for example, when a conservative Baptist drops out or changes religious preference, it's associated with higher educational attainment than the level of the average level of Baptists. But for Latter-day Saints, dropping out or switching religions is associated with a lower level of educational attainment. And a part of that is, there are some religious groups that get together and go to dances. I mean, look at us. We're sitting here in the same kind of form that this is the only thing we know how to do is sit here and listen to someone tell us what we're supposed to know. And only well-educated white folk can do that as well as we can. I do know what you're talking about. We're probably a tribe. in the sense that we form a very strong community and have strong ethnic ties around that community. I would agree with.
Do most sociologists agree with that?
I don't know. Armin, do most sociologists agree with that? Yeah, I know. But Armin, we can't get him convinced about this ethnicity stuff, but he's wrong. So, yeah. Retention, the only one, well, the one that I mentioned, the Melchizedek priesthood, that data is available, and but the person who has it can't say anything. So, I mean, it's only been collected at church headquarters, and the church is not releasing that information. So, yeah. Okay, the Unitarian Universalists were actually the first to ordain women among the Protestants. At the turn of the century, they were ordaining women, and women pastors were pastoring churches on what was then the frontier, the Western frontier. It was in Kansas and around in that area. But the group of women who were those serving as pastors lost organizational autonomy and control to the Unitarians in the East as it moved to the educational institutions in the urban cities of the East. So they basically withdrew their support from the frontier churches, and those were the churches that the women were running. Okay, the question's about the Unitarian Universalists and how they compare with education of...
With the other religious situation, how do they...
The Unitarian Universalists tend to be highly educated, but I can't say much more than that. Actually, in the research that I did, if you take Mormons, only Mormons raised in the church, and compare them with... only Episcopalians raised, Episcopalians, etc. The Mormons are as educated, both the men and the women are as educated as the Episcopalians and Jews. So they're right up there. And that shift has just occurred just within the last, like, 40 years, where Mormonism has moved from a very agrarian society into the cities and more educated and moved up in social class. Yeah. The question's about the men ordained to the priesthood. No, this is data that is simply reported in the yearly almanac that the Deseret News publishes, and it's not information at the individual level where you can do analysis. All you've got is the report, although you can assume that in Africa and some of the hinterlands that those are mostly converts. Yes. But if you look at the... Oh, repeat her question. Let's see. let's see. How do I repeat that question? Do I see the... Carolyn is saying that she doesn't see the Unitarian Universalists fighting as strongly for voice or needing to voice. Well, part of that is they were ordained. I mean, they lost institutional autonomy, but they were ordained.
Seems to have been regained.
Well, you know, how much they've regained is another question, and it's a relative one. Probably, certainly more than Mormon women. Catholic women, I think, are having the same experience as Mormon women. But the difference is that. The gender fight is not over in Protestant religions who are ordaining women. I mean, the women who are ordained still have a difficulty getting parishes. When they do get parishes or congregations, they tend to be assistant pastors rather than... I mean, the most typical experience these days in the, for example, the United Church of Christ in large urban churches is to have a pastor who is male and an assistant pastor who is female who runs the women's organizations. Now, does that sound familiar to you? Now, the difference, of course, is you can marry and whatever, or they can perform marriages, etc. But in terms of actually having access to institutional power, I think even the Protestant women have a ways to go. And if they were honest with you, they'd admit that too. But, I mean, but we're just out of the game still. That's the... The question is, where will women be? I can't answer that today, Carol. yeah, Levina. Question is, retention rates for young women or adult women? I know there's this rumor again going around that having a hard time holding on to teenage women. And a hard time holding on to women. I think that's part of what I address in my paper, that whatever rate, whatever lack of retention we have among women and girls, it is greater among men. And as long as that is true, the focus will always be on the lack of retention for men, because it's men who run the organizations.
But do you know the answer, if it's increasing?
As far as I know, it is not increasing. I've not seen any data suggest that. I don't think the time frame is long enough for us to know what's really going on there and how accurate the data are. One of the problems in terms of knowing, too, about young women is that the data that's collected about young men and young women is different, because we have these ordination dates for the young men that we always know what percent of 12-year-olds haven't been ordained deacon, percent of 14-year-olds haven't been ordained teachers. All we have for the young women is activity data, and part of it may be that young women are not attending the young women organization when they get to be 17, but when you look at that, part of the reason is because not because they're inactive necessarily, but because they're employed or they're doing other things. So we just don't have the right kind of data institutionally to answer that question. Yeah. The question is retention rates among blacks. Well, as I look at this audience, the church as a whole is doing better at integrating blacks than Sunstone is. But I don't know in terms of retention. Are studies being done on minorities? There are two chapters in the book, one on Native Americans and one on African Americans. African Americans and some African citizens, I can't remember, it's several different countries in Africa. That research shows generally that the people who are coming, the blacks who are coming into the church, are the better educated, who are able, and what seems to attract them is to be able to be integrated with whites. And for the most, I mean, and have negative experiences, but for the most part seem to appreciate their experience, at least based on the interviews that Jesse Embry has collected. Okay, way back here. He wants to know the LDS suicide rate compared to the rest of the nation. Teenage suicide rate. I don't know that nationwide. I do know that in Utah, the suicide rate for men, the suicide rate for men and women is higher than the national average, but it seems to be higher for men than it is for women. Yeah. You see it as... For teenagers, and you see it for older adult males. Yeah. Well, the question was, how come men kill themselves more? Part of the reason is that when men attempt suicide, they're more effective. What? I mean, I'm serious. When men attempt suicide, they use a gun or they use something that will work. Women tend to use pills. They don't want to make a mess. I mean, you know, men don't care if they make a mess. Yeah, they don't have to clean it up. So you see very different types. Men also are more likely to die in accidents and are more likely to be killed victims of homicide. So in terms of quality of life, women deal with life, men die. Well, that's because the depressed ones died. I suspect that's what happened, but I don't know. I mean, it's sort of like marital satisfaction. You know, the older you, the more longer you've been married, the higher the marital satisfaction is for a group. Well, that's because those who are unhappy got divorced. Yes. Okay, the question is abuse of women and children. Abuse statistics are very difficult to assess because, for the most part, even child abuse, the records are reported cases, and in fact, they could even be multiple reports of the same case. So you've got some real problems in trying to look at child abuse. One interesting piece of data, this year I'm at the Graduate School of Social Work at the University of Utah, and one of my students has been looking at murder rate in Utah compared to nationally. And one of the things that she's found is that over the last several years, and this has been fairly stable in the United States, about 26% of all murder victims are women. Now, before you get shocked about what I'm going to say, I want you to keep listening to me so you understand, okay, what I'm saying, all right? Because there's an explanation. But in her data, in Utah, in 1990, 46% of all murder victims were women. Okay? Now, the reason I want you to keep listening, the murder rate in Utah is very low compared to nationally. And when someone is killed in this country, they're more likely to be killed by a family member than a stranger. In some of the large cities, where you have a bigger problem with crime, there's more street violence, and men tend to get killed more in that street violence. So part of the fact that 46% of all deaths in Utah are women is simply because men aren't being killed on the streets. You understand that? But the other thing it does say is that when violence occurs in Utah, like anything that occurs in Utah, it's done in families. Okay? So that as we understand the problem of murder in Utah, and this is true elsewhere, we have to understand it as a domestic issue. The other thing is that nationally, the data seem to be suggesting that one of the interesting outcomes of having battered women shelters is that men are less likely to be killed by their wives. Okay, so if the woman is able to get away from her husband and get safe, she's less likely to kill him in the end. Okay, so the benefit, I want all you men to go back to your neighborhoods, the benefit of battered women's shelters is that men don't get killed. Yes?
It is not me.
No, that's not true. No, well, abuse can be in any... the question is abuse only used for physical abuse? No, these days, especially... It depends on the state and what kind of laws are operating in the states, but it covers the full range, emotional, physical, sexual. It's any kind of report of a child who's been neglected or being neglected or abused. Okay? Yeah. Well, actually, one of the things that Larry talks about in his chapter that I didn't mention is that, the Assemblies of God, for example, in what country? I can't remember. You'll have to read the book. Is actually doing better than Mormonism is, despite the high rate that Mormonism is experiencing. And his argument is that Mormonism would do even better if somehow we could lessen the tension and not be exporting the Wasatch Front Church. That if somehow the group down there were allowed to create their own identity as Latter-day Saints, that they would be as effective as the Assemblies of God, because that's what they're doing. Yeah. Okay, the question is, they're more charismatic than the Mormon Church. But that's part of what I'm, the Assembly of God are, that's part of what I'm saying. Mormonism in its youth is charismatic. And Mormonism in the mountains of Latin and Central and South America is charismatic. That's what makes it grow. It's here, or in Salt Lake, or any large body where you get too many white middle-class manager types who bring their educational experience, their management experience, into the operation of a Mormon congregation. And it becomes rationalized and structured. It's not like that elsewhere. I mean, one of the most wonderful experiences I had was to walk in to a church in Birmingham, England, where more than half the congregation were black. That was not my typical Mormon experience. Okay? What?
Why?
Because I don't often go to black congregations in Birmingham, England. Well, it was far more charismatic and open, and people were talking about how, the Relief Society president talked about how God had made it possible for her family to eat by delivering a pizza while she took care of a woman down the street, and they didn't have any money, and, how are they going to afford this, and the local pizza parlor donated two pizzas to her husband, and they came home and ate pizza. I mean... I guess I'm just too far on the East Bench in Salt Lake. No, they don't deliver. I mean, no one stands up and says, God delivered a pizza at my house. Well, they stand up and they say, I'm so grateful that God's given me all these wonderful blessings. I have a four-wheel drive Jeep. I have an eight-bedroom home. Okay, I mean, but the focus of the tension was two pizzas. Okay, one more question. We need to quit. Yeah. Okay, the question is, talking with a Catholic priest, he wants to know how Mormonism keeps their children active, because he's seeing a lot of people falling away in his parish. Catholicism generally is having a problem because it is so oriented on liturgy and ritual that that there's nothing for the kids to identify with. Actually, I think the strength in Mormonism is not only the emphasis on family, but the incredible amount of opportunity for young people to interact with adults who share their same value system. So during that critical period in which teenagers are separating from mom and dad and having to disagree with them on everything, there is another adult who doesn't have necessarily an authority relationship with them, whose self-esteem is not based on what this child does, and who can be more, kind of nurturing and a surrogate parent. And that happens in LDS wards. Okay, I'm getting kind of warm and you're tired. Thank you.